Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
This podcast was produced Wednesday, April 27th at 3:03 p.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like we'll have an election where we do not argue about mail-in ballots, voting machines, proof of citizenship. We'll wait. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who want to hear from their constituents when they are back in their districts during summer break, but only under carefully coordinated conditions. I'm Mike Thompson. This week on the podcast, we will relive last week's Politics and a Pint event that we held at Seven Sun Brewing in Columbus. If you have never been to one, they're a lot of fun. Four of us get up on bar stools and we talk politics in front of a pretty good sized crowd of public media political junkies. With the help of a craft beer or two, last week we recapped the first 8 months of the Trump administration and the first 8 months of Ohio politics in 2025. Here it is.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the summer 2025 edition of WOSU Public Media's Politics in a Pint. We are very glad you are here and you have given up one of the final summer evenings to be with us to discuss politics. As the late, great Jimmy Buffett once said, it's been quite a summer. And even without the rental cars and westbound trains, it has been quite a summer, quite a spring, quite a late winter. It has been 212 days since President Trump was inaugurated the 47th President of the United States. And a lot has changed since then on the federal level. Here in Ohio, the never-ending campaign cycle continues. It did not start or stop on Inauguration Day. Now candidates are either formally or informally starting their campaigns for the 2026 governor's race, U.S. Senate race, other races here in Ohio. The state legislature came back, the brand new state legislature came back into session in January, and they spent the winter and spring cramming every non-fiscal policy for the state of Ohio they could into the state budget. They did very little about the biggest issue facing many of us, and that is the rising property taxes. So that's still to come. The Intel project may be in trouble, may be okay, depends on the day. Depends on the president's mood. Mike DeWine sent military troops to Washington, D.C. We'll get to that. And Ohio State University has banned sidewalk chalk, which is the biggest outrage on campus. So we have a lot to talk about. Let me introduce our panel. First, Amy Jurevich, my colleague at WOSU. She hosts All Sides with Amy Jurevich, 10 to noon, weekdays on 89.7 NPR News. Andrew Tobias, politics, State House reporter for Signal Statewide, a fairly new but very solid nonprofit news organization. Welcome to the nonprofit world, Andrew. And Karen Kassler, she's the State House Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio and TV. All right, let's get right into it. Amy Jurevich, it has been a whirlwind start to the Trump administration. Let me list the things. We have the Gulf of America, we have DOGE, we have tariffs, we have beautiful bills, Jeffrey Epstein, peace negotiations, and we have KISS as a Kennedy Center nominee or honoree. Now that's something I did not call in fifth grade, channeling Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. Anyway, how are you keeping up with it all on your show?
How are we keeping up with the news? Well, there is no lack of things to talk about, let's say that. Whereas some would have called a few years of the Biden administration a little bit boring, it is definitely not boring. Whenever we sit down and have our editorial meetings to decide what we should do shows on, we have too many topics and too many things we could talk about. So there's a plethora of things. So How do I keep up with it all? Well, I listen to public radio. That's a good start. That helps. There's a lot to keep up on. It can be heavy at times, but we also try to incorporate some lighter things into the show too. So yeah, I don't know how to keep up with it, honestly.
Yeah, it's a fire hose. Karen, there are two things going on. There's the emotional reaction, whether you support the president or oppose the president to what's been happening over the past 8 months. And then there's the actual things that are happening. Let's start with the emotional reaction here in Ohio. How have state lawmakers, Republican and Democrat, reacted, and how are they coping with the new Trump administration? And then average Ohioans, what have you seen?
Well, certainly you've got Republicans who are in the supermajority in the House and Senate lining up behind the things that the Trump administration has been doing. I mean, you just saw it as you all reacted pretty strongly about Governor Mike DeWine sending Ohio National Guard troops to D.C. He said that that was a decision that was kind of in a way out of his hands. He was requested to send these troops. I talked to him on Monday about this, and he said that his only decision was that these would not be law enforcement because he didn't want to deplete local police departments, but he was doing this just like he had done it for Governor Tim Walz in Minnesota when he had requested National Guard during the George Floyd protests. So you've seen a lot of that kind of reaction where what the administration is doing, Republicans have been going along with it. I mean, even going back to like Senate Bill 1, the anti-DEI, the anti-woke bill that is now law that affects colleges, public colleges and universities in Ohio. And that really falls right along with what we've seen from the Trump administration about diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. People, individuals, I mean, I think the folks in this room have been pretty clear on how you feel about some of this stuff. But, you know, Trump has maintained popularity in Ohio in terms of the last three election cycles. And I went back and looked at elections from 1994 on. And statewide elections, Republicans have won 82% of statewide elections since 1994 till 2024. So this is a red state. It's been a red state for some time, even though it did swing during the presidential years. We did have 2006 when Democrats won. This maintains, I think, its red state status, and it's certainly kind of lost its bellwether status in the sense that there were counties that voted like the rest of the nation, and that's just not happening in Ohio anymore.
Andrew, there's been, I want to say, seems like biweekly, monthly protests at the State House. They were large gatherings. Have they maintained their momentum? Right off the bat, there were big protests. And then as each Trump administration development decision policy stance came out, those protests seemed to grow. Are they strong? Or are they petering out?
That's an interesting question, because I remember when Donald Trump won the first time, and it was a shock to everyone, including him, I'm pretty sure. And so there was a really strong backlash immediately. I remember when he implemented his Muslim ban, there were just hundreds of people that showed up at the Cleveland Hopkins Airport to protest, including Sherrod Brown and other Democrats. There also was a pretty strong reaction from, I used to work for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, so I'm thinking about this in Cleveland terms, but the local healthcare systems, there's a lot of international people who come in to work in the hospitals and healthcare. What I found to be the case after this win by Trump was that on the left, people were really dispirited. I think that in the past, they may have seen 2016 as a fluke. You know, I think that they might have thought that the Russia interference or some other factor might have kind of decided, helped decide what happened there. And that's kind of a counterfactual. It's hard to prove. But Trump won the popular vote for the first time. The Republican had done that for a very long time. And so long way of saying, I think the mood initially among the left and Democratic officials was kind of like soul searching, depression almost. And then I saw with the protest movements, I think it's a place for them to kind of channel their energy. Something that I saw, Tim Walz, you mentioned, came here to Ohio in, I think it was April. And he since has said he's not running for president, but if somebody from Minnesota who's a politician shows up in Ohio, okay, you're running for president maybe, But the energy in the room at a town hall that he held in Youngstown that I saw was the strongest I've seen of any Democratic event for a while. And part of that is because they've stopped campaigning here for presidential elections. So I think there's, as far as just like I don't really put that much stock in individual protests. It's always hard to know kind of what goes into them. You know, if like 20 people show up to protest some issue, does that mean the issue is not important? Like, no. Like, so, but I have been keeping tabs on this kind of like emotional trajectory from the left. And I'm really curious about, in 2018, there was a very strong national climate for Democrats, and whether that's the, I'm curious whether that'll be again, the case again next year.
Yeah, we shall see. You know, the actual impact of the Trump policies, we're just perhaps starting to see it now. Inflation is roughly the same as it was when Biden left office, 2.5-3%. It's been pretty steady. It's creeped up a bit. The tariffs, I think we were waiting for the tariff impact to affect how we bought cars, washer machines. Farmers were waiting to see if there was a trade war, Amy. We haven't seen any of that. It's only been 212 days. But we haven't seen that yet, really.
Yeah, I would say that when it comes to the economic impacts, I think we're still waiting for some of them. Every week on Tech Tuesday, if you listen to Tech Tuesday, we have Russell Hawley on. He's the director of commerce content at CNET. And if you've heard me, I've asked him on several shows weeks in a row, CNET has a tariff tracker. And I'll ask him, so any updates on the tariff tracker, Russell? Any updates? And most recently, this past week or the week before, I can't remember, he said that for the first time, the cost of something like a Nintendo Switch is up. And so the Switch 2, like the Switch 1 went up, but not
y'all
the Switch 2.
Y'all know what a
2.
Nintendo Switch is?
Yeah. Yeah.
How many gamers are out there? I want to know. Okay.
So this is just an example where he was saying that having the Nintendo 1, the older Nintendo Switch, go up is the start of the impact of the tariffs. But Nintendo said they were reacting to the market. So he said the time to look for these tariff things is going to be as we head into holiday shopping season. Because whether or not the tariffs are actually impacting them, manufacturers of high demand products are going to say that they are, and they're going to increase their prices because they can. That's marketing, that's the market. But you know, Mike was saying, you know, have there been on the ground actual impacts of the Trump administration and things that are happening? Some of those are yet to come. We haven't seen them yet, but you know, the one that we have seen is the federal funding cut for public media. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is closing. We did lose $2 million. So yes, there are real impacts.
Yeah. A lot of research at Ohio State and other universities affected by DOGE cuts. To the, Karen, to the troops issue, when sending the National Guard, 150 National Guard troops from Ohio sent to Washington, D.C., to help with police there, other states' National Guard, to patrol the streets for what the president has described as a terrible crime situation. I looked up, Cleveland's violent crime rate is much higher than D.C.'s. Violent crime in Cleveland is significantly higher than Washington, D.C. The murder rate in Cleveland is slightly lower, but Cleveland is higher. Are we going to send National Guard troops to Cleveland next?
Well, I think that's the concern, is what happens when you send troops because of a crime emergency, which is what Trump has said, though violent crime in D.C. is at a 30-year low. What is the next step? And when I talked to DeWine, he said this was a 30-day assignment. So within 30 days, we're supposed to know whether they're coming home or what. But yeah, there's a real fear of the weaponization of these people who are community members. These are not trained law enforcement, like I said, because he said he didn't want people who are serving as police officers to go to D.C. And tonight, President Trump is going to be out with the troops on the streets of D.C. So certainly there's going to be people who believe that this is political theater, that it's not with... Trump, a 79-year-old man, out walking with the military who are doing whatever they're doing, and with crime at a 30-year low. This is not serious, some people believe. The question is, though, is what happens next? Where do we go from here? Does this just fade away, or does it potentially escalate? And other cities, which Republicans have talked about as being lawless and full of violent crime, are other cities next?
Yeah, J.D. Vance said that Columbus was lawless, and of the three major cities, we're doing quite well compared to D.C., Cleveland, and Cincinnati. Our crime rate and our murder rate is significantly lower than those cities are.
Well, and also crime does have a way to tie with the economy. And so if the economy starts to suffer, you have to be worried about what might happen to the crime rate.
Bottom line is, Andrew, it's kind of like inflation. during the campaign. The Democrats were saying, you know, it's not that bad. But people were feeling it. And people in D.C. were seeing their cars getting stolen. Carjackings were up. So it wasn't just perception. There was anecdotal, maybe not showing up in the stats. I was a little surprised because Mike DeWine has done a good job of supporting the President Trump without really embracing him. This he seemed to really immediately embrace a Trump policy that was controversial. The first weekend, they were one of the first states to send their guard troops to D.C.
Yeah, that is interesting. Something that I've just generally observed from Governor DeWine is that he's very pragmatic about maintaining a relationship with the federal government. And so I think that was actually easier for him when Biden was president, because the two of them served in the U.S. Senate together. I think they had a pretty warm personal relationship. He's on and off again with Trump, to say the least. So, I've not talked to him about why he jumped at this chance. I think it is true that he has sent the National Guard to other states when requested in the past. So, but yeah, I don't know what I'll say besides that.
Of course, you don't want to get sideways with the president and refuse the request, because then you really would be, you'd be up on Truth Social within moments. So that's probably what he was trying to avoid.
DeWine has been there before, so I'm sure he will again.
Let's move on to 2026, if it's not too early. We're technically about a year away from the election. The primary is next May. Filing deadline for candidates is in February, but most candidates now are starting to line up. Amy, the big news, we were all waiting. I joked on my show that we're trying to read the tea leaves one leaf at a time. Would Sherrod Brown run for governor? Would he run for Senate? Would he just stay home? And he's moved, lived to Bexley now and hang out with his grandkids. But he's going back to the Senate. At least he wants to. What do you think's going on there, Amy?
Well, I think that everyone's happy that Sherrod Brown finally made a decision. I do know one person who is happy that he made a decision. Earlier this week, I interviewed Dr. Amy Acton, who's running for governor, and she is happy to have that question mark off of her plate. I think that there were a lot of people in Ohio, union labor leaders, wanted Sherrod Brown to run for governor. They were ready to back him. They were wanting that. But there were lots of reports of Chuck Schumer coming to Columbus more than once and having dinner with Sherrod Brown. And Chuck Schumer doesn't come to Columbus to have dinner with Sherrod Brown just for fun. I think that there was a ulterior motive there. So I was not surprised whenever he decided Senate, but I think that on behalf of political reporters and people in politics, we're all happy that he finally decided, so now we can all move on.
Karen, you've covered Sherrod Brown for a long time. I've watched him for a long time. I just had a hard time envisioning him as governor. He was Secretary of State, so he had an executive position with the state, but he's been in Congress for a long time, Senate for a long time. To come back and be the chief executive of the state, I'd see him more as a legislator. Is he more, do you think, it's hard to get in his head. I'm not asking you to get in his head, but it seemed like the Senate is where he probably is more comfortable.
Well, when he set up his Dignity of Work Institute in March, the messaging of that really sounded national to a lot of us, because he talked about the concerns of working people and lower income people. And it wasn't just targeted toward Ohioans. It was really trying to look at things from, I think, a national perspective, which kind of leads you to believe that maybe the Senate is where he was looking at. I mean, he's one of, if he wins, whoever's in the Senate, they're one of 100. Whereas if you're the governor, you're the person in the executive office. So it's totally different roles. But I think Amy's right that there was a little bit of a relief that, okay, now we know what's happening with this person. There's one other one that a lot of people are waiting to see what happens, and that's, of course, former Congressman Tim Ryan. And he keeps kind of teasing it, throwing it out there, that he'll make a decision soon, and that his phone's been blowing up now that Sherrod Brown's made his decision. So, but I think Democrats do have a serious issue in filling out the rest of that ticket for next year, because Republicans, most of whom are already in one office and they're term limited, they're going to different offices. They've got name recognition, they've got money, and so Democrats are starting behind in a state that is already, as I just said earlier, showing that things are stacked against them. So there's work to be done and not a whole lot of time to do it if you are a Democrat.
Andrew, Sherrod Brown's opponent is current U.S. Senator John Husted, recently left his job as lieutenant governor. He is filling out the term of J.D. Vance, so they have to run again by law. in next year. These are two very well-known, established, everyone wants a fresh face. These are not fresh faces, even though John Houston's fresh to the federal government. How do you see this race shaping up?
It'll be an interesting kind of contrast. I don't know, I don't want to step on any questions about the governor's race, but we're going to have Vivek Ramaswamy in all likelihood on the Republican side there. And he is, while he's no stranger to politics now, I had never heard of him until about 2 years ago. And it's a pretty big, a meteoric climb to become the front runner to be the governor of Ohio from there. But Ramaswamy's has a history of saying more controversial things. It's, you know, some of the positions that he took when he ran for president in 2024. Houston, on the other hand, is more of a kind of traditional Republican, and he also had a traditional trajectory where he ran for the state legislature, he got elected to a legislative leadership position, then he climbed a statewide office, and he tried to run for governor, and then he dropped out and became Mike DeWine's lieutenant governor, and then Mike DeWine appointed him to the U.S. Senate, and that's how politics worked for a long time. So we'll have a chance to see what voters think kind of in the contrast there. I know that we saw in 2022, Mike DeWine, the epitome of a traditional politician, won by about 30 points. J.D. Vance, who was more of a political outsider type, only won by 7 or 6, actually, I believe. Lost to Tim Ryan, by the way. Mm-hmm. So that says to me that there is the sort of mainstream of Ohio is more like John Husted, probably. But, you know, I guess we'll have to see. Like you said, our politics have changed where voters increasingly want to hear from somebody new. We're going to have two old voices in Ohio running.
Has anybody seen Vivek Ramaswamy on the stump or extended him speak anywhere in extended time? He's a force. He is a force. He is dynamic on the stump. He is a wonderful speaker. No notes. I mean, he maybe go off a little bit off on tangent. He said that he wanted to zero out property taxes and income taxes, which probably went, he had to walk that back to use the cliche. But that's he's going to be leading the ticket, right? I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy, this is the fresh face, has a lot of money, Trump endorsed. He's going to be the headline on this campaign probably.
Yeah, that's what everyone says they want in politics. They want a fresh face. They want someone new. Everyone who is in every office is old and has been around for a long time, and that they want new people. So Vivek Ramaswamy fits that bill completely. And I would say on the Democratic side, Dr. Amy Acton is trying to fit that bill as well. So she says she is not a politician. She is a problem solver, and she is an advocate, and that's why she's running. So she is running to be the fresh face. I don't know how old Tim Ryan is, but she is basically arguing that she is the non-politician running for a seat to make a change by having someone who's not a seasoned politician in the office.
Karen, Amy Acton and Vivek Ramaswamy will be quite a contrast if they're the final two. We'll get to Tim Ryan.
I think that's an if. Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything beyond what we know right now, but there is a long time until then. Yeah. And yes, you're talking about Amy Acton's very soft-spoken, very direct and clear in what she's saying, but she's got a totally different way of speaking than Vivek Ramaswamy, who I suppose you could in some ways call him bombastic. You were right. He's a force. So debates would be interesting if we ever see debates again, which I'm very worried about. But you've already seen the Republicans start their campaign against Amy Acton, bring up the lockdowns during COVID, which were lockdowns that came from Governor Mike DeWine and other people in the administration, but she is being put out there as the face of all of that people ended up coming to really get frustrated over. So the campaign against her has already started, which is to be expected considering that Republicans really want to hang on to all of these offices. They want to sweep like they did in 2010, basically, and have continued to.
Listening to her on Amy's show this week, Andrew, she's getting there on her. You know, she always had this very empathetic image with the wine with DeWine and the slopes and the Swiss cheese and all that stuff.
Flatten the curve.
That's all gone now.
Yeah.
It's disappearing fast. She was on her talking points. She had her message. She had her stump speech down. Still wasn't you know, Vivek Ramaswamy in your face, but she's getting there. Do you think she can become, take for example, Amy asked her, do you support Governor DeWine's decision to send the troops to Washington, D.C.? Every Democrat on the planet said, I oppose that. She deferred. She said, well, I would have serious concerns. I don't want to second guess the governor. Is that going to cut it in a Democratic?
And then I asked her again, because I was like, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And she was being Amy Acton. But will that work in the rough and tumble arena of gubernatorial politics, whether it's a primary or the general?
So there's two thoughts. So I'm going to say them out loud so I don't forget. One is kind of Amy Acton's communication style. And then the other one is kind of like her experience being running for office. So I guess starting with her communication style, it actually is a really interesting contrast because, again, like I guess not a lot of people raised their hands when they asked if Vivek Ramaswamy, if they seen him speak. I find his stump speeches, he uses this kind of like grandiose language about like the founding fathers, which he's tried to adapt to apply to like the settling of Ohio, and it doesn't really exactly land. You can tell he read a book about it and that he's incorporated that into his speech. But where he really thrives is in a more unstructured conversation. He's good at sounding like he's not speaking in talking points when he actually is. And it's like listening to a male podcast where I've seen him go on Twitch streams with like video game people who now for some reason are really important in the sort of Donald Trump like communication.
We're back to that
world.
Nintendo game. What was it called?
Switch.
Nintendo Switch. Twitch and Switch. Keeping it straight.
He has a very eclectic kind of media appearances he's made. Amy Acton, on the other hand, obviously is very experienced being on TV with the Wine with DeWine stuff. I remember being scared with COVID. We didn't really know what was happening. And she was very calming. Like, I think that's kind of how she became who she is as a public figure. I think of her more of like a female-oriented podcast. There's been this huge bifurcation in gender, in communication. I think they both kind of like represent different spheres of that. So then as far as her polish as a politician, that struck me when she was on Amy's show. I listened and had a similar reaction. I think that she is trying to run in a sort of subtle way as a continuation of Mike DeWine's administration. I think she saw what I referred to earlier, which is that Mike DeWine won by 30 points and J.D. Vance won by 6 points. And so I think that when you put her on the spot, asking her, she's like, do I criticize Mike DeWine? No, I'm not supposed to do that. Like, but this is bad. Democrats hate this. And so I think she kind of short-circuited a little bit. And so as she gets faced with those moments where there's a difficult, you know, I guess, choice where she has to make, maybe she'll get more experience doing that. But that is definitely a sign of her kind of lack of experience being a candidate.
Still have a long way to go. I mean.
And there is a challenge here of trying to get voters who have voted Republican to come over to voters who have voted Republican, who don't like Trump, who don't like some of his policies, to get them to come over to vote for a Democrat. That is a challenge that all Democrats are going to have to face in terms of bringing people along. And you're going to see, I mean, Tim Ryan tried it to be more of a moderate. And Sherrod Brown was kind of positioned as being a moderate, though his record is not moderate. I think that you can't win as a Democrat in Ohio with just Democratic votes. You have to potentially bring in, you have to bring in independents, definitely. And you want to try to bring in frustrated Trump voters who are Republican but don't really like it right now.
So that's the question. Will there be a Democratic primary? Tim Ryan has given himself a deadline, at least his campaign has, the end of September, to make a decision. So that means Amy Acton's on hold now for another month as far as fundraising goes. But Amy, she told you she's in to stay.
She told me that she is not interested in being distracted by hypotheticals, so she is running for governor, and she's sticking to it. I asked her if she would want to be Tim Ryan's lieutenant governor, or vice versa. Would Tim Ryan be her lieutenant governor? And she just reiterated that she is not interested in hypotheticals and is running for governor. And so I guess secretly behind the scenes, yes, she's probably waiting for Tim Ryan to make a decision.
Do you know what the ultimate hypothetical is? Amy Acton as governor. Politicians never want to deal with hypotheticals when they're running for office they don't have, because that is an ultimate hypothetical. Anyway, I rant here a little bit. So Tim Ryan ran against J.D. Vance, lost, you know, within 10 points, which is pretty good these days. And the key for Democrats in this state is to rack up big margins in the city, and don't lose by big margins in the rural areas. I would think that Tim Ryan would have a better chance of that in the rural areas, who were very much anti-COVID shutdowns, very much anti-masks. They're not going to vote for Amy Acton, are they? They're going to vote for Tim Ryan, maybe. Right?
Well, when you look at a map of how Ohio has changed, and there used to be a really great website that kind of allowed you to see a graphic of how the map has changed in Ohio. And for Democrats, it was really kind of, it gave you hope because you saw how the state used to be really, really blue, and it wasn't, it was in the lifetimes of most of us here in this room. But things have changed dramatically, especially in the rural areas. Republicans have really gained a lot when it comes to rural voters. And in counties especially, Republicans really played a long game in getting local races and getting Republicans elected to county commissions, to councils and school boards and township trustees and all of that. And so you now have a situation where, I'm trying to remember, I tweeted out two maps, one from 1995 and one from 2024, showing the divide of county commissions, how many of them were Republican, Democrat, whatever. Now, almost all county commissions outside of the major cities are Republican. So that's what Democrats are up against, is going into these rural communities. And it's not just Amy Acton. Tim Ryan tried to do it, and it wasn't very successful for him either. But that is the work that has to be done by Democrats, is reaching some of these voters who have now, in many cases, been conditioned to dislike Democrats just because they're Democrats and not even really listen to some of the issues. And that's very frustrating for Democrats. You've got Chris Gibbs, for instance, who's a former Shelby County Republican Party chair who switched and is now the Democratic Party chair in Shelby County. And he's fighting that as a farmer in a rural area, trying to get people to just listen to Democrats and consider what they have to say.
Let's get on to statewide politics, the state legislature, and the governor just finished the long budget process. And the number one issue on a lot of folks, there's a lot of issues that are important, but rising property taxes. Because of rising property values, on average, property taxes have gone up 30%, 35% across the board. Andrew, there was efforts to try to do something on the state level to try to cut property taxes, at least stop the quick rise of property taxes, but they couldn't get anything done. Why was that? They got a little done.
So, I mean, the short answer is that it's a really complicated issue and that it's hard to decide if you cut, you know, we all hate taxes, but we enjoy our services that we receive. And so what are you going to cut if you're going to cut taxes? I mean, it gets more complicated than that, but I think one of the reasons why it's going to be hard politically is that Karen was just saying how much of the state has become Republican now, but there are different kind of types of Republican communities, and it kind of gets flattened out in national politics. But a big divide in the Republican Party, for instance, is there's this traditional focus from more conservative Republicans on school privatization and having vouchers and school choice and all that stuff. There are no private schools in rural areas. The public school there is like the mascot for the community. And so that's a huge divide. And so I think there are some communities where they were not gung-ho about, if their school superintendent tells them that this bill is going to make me have to fire teachers or, you know, make bus routes twice as long, like that's a real concern for them. And so it's just a really intractable political problem, but it's also one that is urgent because there are people, it's a classic kitchen table issue where you picture like the person looking at the bills on their table and trying to think about what they're going to pay for. So, but things are kind of they're studying it more, but they've studied it before.
Yes,
too, you
know? There's a working group. Governor DeWine has a working group. They met today.
Yes.
Did they find a solution? Or are they still working?
They solved it?
They're still working.
Governor DeWine loves working groups. If you haven't been, working groups, task force, blue ribbon commissions, he loves them all. Anyway, there is a campaign out there. It's very early. They want to get on the ballot next November with a constitutional amendment that would do away with the property tax in Ohio. Karen, what do you make of this campaign? Is it a serious campaign? It's all volunteers. Is there any sort of legitimate, solid group backing this campaign?
Well, I was just looking to try to find, there was an analysis that somebody did for me about what it would take if you had to replace income taxes and property taxes in Ohio with a sales tax. You'd end up with about a 20% sales tax in Ohio to replace both of those. So when people start talking about getting rid of, the legislature's already on a track, a 20, 25-year track of getting rid of income taxes, or at least lowering them. But if you start talking about getting rid of property taxes, that's what it would take. And when I sat down with one of the leaders of this group to abolish property taxes, I asked him, okay, you want to get rid of property taxes, what do you want to replace it with? And he said, well, that's the legislature's job. Which, okay. It's a very simplistic answer, but the problem is it sounds great. You don't want to pay property taxes anymore because they're going up. They really are helping or are encouraged. They're making it really hard for people to afford basic things, especially when you've paid off your house and all of that. But then what do you do to fund schools, law enforcement, libraries, zoos, aging, mental health, all of that? And that's the real challenge here. And this is a problem that's been building for years and years and years in the legislature and has not been addressed because it's hard. Once you change one thing, it affects other things. And so there's some ideas been talked about. I think one of
it's our fault, though, Karen.
What?
These property taxes, when levies rise, they don't just rise on their own. I mean, property values go up and they go up. We vote for them.
Well, absolutely. Yes.
I mean, communities.
But don't you support your libraries and your zoos?
Yes.
And
yes. So that is.
But a lot of these entities have gone to voters because their funding has been cut in other areas. So that's the real question, is if you want the services, how do you want to pay for them? But how do you also limit the growth of these property taxes? Because that's no fault of your own if you're paying a lot more in property taxes now than you did just a couple of years ago. And there are some things that are being talked about in that working group, a circuit breaker, which would lower property taxes or cap them at a certain point of income, percentage of your income, homestead exemption, some things like that. But some of these things involve the state actually putting in money to help with that, and that I think is a big question, is there are state lawmakers that don't want the state to have to put money into it.
I wanted to add something. I think part of the problem is I don't know that legislators understand how property taxes work, and
how many people have actually looked in detail at your property tax bill? How many entities are on that bill that you pay property taxes to? I counted mine up a couple of weeks ago. I think it was 12. There's the zoo, there's my school district, there's my township, which basically is my fire department, there's the developmental disabilities board, there was libraries. I mean, why do we have, and each one of those goes to the voters every once in a while and asks for more money, and Amy, you're not gonna vote against the library, you're not gonna vote against the children. So why property taxes go up?
Sometimes people do vote against the children. I mean, there was a whole campaign in the Olentangy School District where there were signs and yards everywhere that said, it's okay to vote no. Is it? I don't know.
But, I mean, we're talking about $28 billion that comes into government coffers from property taxes. And if you want to continue to have services, they have to be funded somehow. And sure, there's a lot of talk about streamlining and like, especially with schools. And I've been around long enough that this is the second time I've heard this whole thing about let's combine school districts. And you know, that brings up the question, do you want your school district combined with another school district? Or would that be a problem if you're combined with a school district
that
you don't
like?
What
about my football team?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, trying to streamline and come up with ways to economize, but that only does so much, because really the biggest source of the money where the money mostly goes to from property taxes to schools, for instance, goes to teachers and goes to the people who are working in those school buildings, educating kids and making sure that they're okay.
Andrew, lawmakers waited to legalize casinos and voters beat them to it. They waited to legalize marijuana and voters beat them to it. They refused to enact a compromise law that on reproductive rights and abortion, and voters beat them to it and put it in the Constitution. This could be on the ballot next November. Will lawmakers wait again for voters to beat them to this property tax solution?
So I can't tell if how seriously the legislature is taking that campaign. I know people ask me for my opinion about it, and I can't think of a single example of a truly grassroots campaign collecting the likes. You have to get, is it 413,000 signatures, including an amount equal to like 5% of the electorate from the last governor's election in 44 counties. So you have to reach a minimum number in half of the counties across the state. And typically, a lot of signatures are rejected. And so you often, the rule of thumb is you collect twice as many as you need in case the people you got a signature from filled something out wrong. Maybe they're not actually registered to vote. Maybe they've moved, you know, their voter file doesn't match what they put in the form. So the idea of collecting, of a bunch of volunteers collecting 850,000 signatures from across the state, to me, just seems very unlikely. But it's such a potent political issue that I wouldn't completely rule it out. So I don't know whether lawmakers, they'll reference the campaign, and I don't know if that's just like a tactic to try to like get people to vote for something, but that is a real thing. And we've seen in Summit County, the county council there has acted to cap property tax increases. And I think that, you know, if people ignore this issue, I think they do at their own peril, because whether it's that amendment campaign or whether it's some kind of like tax revolt that shows up in some other way, I view it as like a very important issue, just if I'm a politician, to solve, because it's hard to say exactly what will happen if they don't.
The last time I remember seeing a volunteer effort that got to the ballot was a statute, which was the Smoke-Free Ohio, the one that banned smoking in public buildings. But as I recall, there was also, at the same time, another proposal on that same ballot that would do something a little bit different, that the bars and restaurants and other groups, so they took it very seriously, and that was a statute, that was a law. This is a constitutional amendment. So it, like Andrew says, it's a huge hill to get up, even though they have until next July to raise that kind of signatures. It's a lot.
And maybe some rich person who hates taxes will decide to cut him a check, and then that'll completely change the game. But I've not seen that yet.
You really do need, the reality is you need professional signature gathering companies.
Absolutely.
And that was the
that's how it's been done by every other constitutional amendment that's gotten to the ballot, is they've hired at least some help.
Okay. But it is enticing if someone's standing outside of your library gathering signatures and all they have to do is say, do you hate property taxes? Sign this.
Yeah. Do you hate property taxes? Vote no. That's a pretty, pretty, in every other state, these property tax limiting measures have, over the years, over the decades, have been successful.
And I'll throw, like, North Dakota voted one down that was like this, so I think it would be a competitive election.
Yeah, it would be interesting to watch, because there would be the anti-tax folks, but all the public employees, unions would be out, their supporters, people would, there would be a very vigorous campaign laying out the consequences.
A very vigorous and expensive campaign. If you remember Senate Bill 5, which was the collective bargaining law change, and you saw the reaction to that, that this would make Senate Bill 5 just, it would pale in comparison.
That was WOSU's Summer 2025 Politics and the Pint. I was joined by WOSU's Amy Jurevich, Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler, and Signal Statewide's Andrew Tobias. We have another Politics and a Pint coming up in October. We will share details as we get closer, so please be on the lookout for them. We would love to have you join us. Again, they are a lot of fun. That will do it for this week's edition of Snolligoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just tell your friends about us. That's the best way to get the word out about our work. And all our thanks to our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineers this week, live on location, Dalton Jones, Kevin Petrilla, and Holly Rutledge. I'm Mike Thompson for Snolligoster from WOSU Public Media.